welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. I don't want to go down the path because nine times out of ten it takes up the whole morning, or at least the first half of the show. And I know this is an evening show, but I pre-record these every day. And so that way, if somebody's been assassinated or something like that, we can really cover it, at least make mention of it, because especially on Mondays and Fridays, because that's where these are kind of time dominant. We never repeat these shows. If you hear this show being repeated, it's only because we have been denied service or access to the broadcasting, and that happens every once in a while. It just hasn't been a long time, or it was just a couple of weeks ago, but before that, it seemed like all year we were pretty good. Anyway, you're welcome to exercise your faith. You can do that on your own. You can start up your own prayer circle, but we would recommend, if you would like to join others, there's the Loudoun Liberty Prayer Circle. That information is on Reclaiming the Republic Red State Talk Radio podcast page. And most importantly, your campaign begins now. It begins today. And as a matter of fact, kind of interesting how things kind of work out. Because we've got a lot of movement in several states, and I'm at a point where I want to use up the rest of my available time in helping people get organized and helping people actually come to this, you know, come to the point of being able to actually start making the difference. Nine times out of ten, folks, what we see all the time is we keep on helping decent people get elected to become corrupt. It's not their fault. They don't know what they're doing. This is why we actually need to make sure that the guys and gals going in, know what they're doing. If they don't understand the Constitution, if they don't take an oath to support it and actually live by that oath, then they're a part of the problem. They're a big part of the problem. And if you're not holding them accountable, then you're the biggest part of the problem. Folks, the people are the biggest part of the problem we have with government today. We do not have a government, even though people may want that kind of government. We do not have a democracy. We do not have socialism. We do not have this thing called, you know, redistribution of wealth, social justice. Those things are not within the government that was formed. And everybody believes, well, we can kind of, well, you know what? Interestingly enough, there has been more evidence that's actually proven by some of the actions, even though there are government players that, I'll just say like justices. There are justices that still kind of, oh, well, we want to let the progressive model really go here. We're willing to do all of these subversive things, but we're not going to relinquish our control. In other words, it's like the Senate. The Senate would yammer if the president ever just said, you know, you are now the Secretary of State. Go ahead and sit down. Go get in the office and start working, bypassing the Senate's advice and consent. The Senate would just cry bloody murder. Hey, we have control. Well, hold on here. You guys are, you know, doing all these things you shouldn't be doing, so why can't I? I mean, literally, it is almost at that point where everybody is allowing everybody to do everything because they know they're equally bad. They're all equally corrupt. So your campaign begins now. You need to start working with petitions, and we have plenty of petitions to get you started. Now, there's going to be people that will want to actually drive other petitions that are really more, I'll say, germane to the local problems. But when it comes to the really big problems and when it comes to the Constitution, there's a reason why we have these, because they're applicable in every county and every state. This repository, if you go to reclaimingtherepublic.org, we have a repository of petitions that can be used in any county, any state, because these are all petitions pointing to the U.S. Constitution and how it's being violated, which means that anybody that's under oath should take a stand and actually call out the infraction and demand compliance. This is what is required. We've already read this. We just recently read this, and that's Madison stating that all infractions must be opposed. So what the heck is going on? Why is it that these good guys aren't opposing it? Oh, well, if you oppose them, then they're going to oppose you. Well, they can't oppose you if you're actually upholding the Constitution. Anyway, I'm hoping this makes sense. And so what we actually did on Friday is we spent an inordinate amount of time, and I said this going in, that this was going to be a multi-parter. And so I'm going to try to break off so that we can get back to part three on Friday. But what we're covering right now is, excuse me, I'm sorry, I got this perpetual frog. What we're covering is the reconstituting of our national security system. What does that mean? Reconstituting our national security system. Our national security system is, guess who? You. That's why the Second Amendment says that you must have guns. And so one of the things we should have, we already have in place in the criminal justice system, we kind of have in place this protection that an innocent man should never go to jail. A human, or I should say a U.S. citizen, should never really lose their right to bear arms. But when we're in a society that has fully enveloped the self-militia, or I should say the self-governing system, where the militia is actually doing its job, then people don't necessarily have to have guns if they don't want to, unless they're required to serve. Then you have no choice. And if you choose to be a conscientious objector, then that's another story. Then you can be a medic. You'll have to learn some type of technical training so that you don't have to carry a gun. Now, and kill people. I think that's the real point of the conscientious objection, being in a combat mode where you would actually have to pull the trigger to kill somebody. That is a feasible conscientious objection. They did not play down this path of saying, what about these other moral things? And technically, Madison was pretty clear in his essay on property. I always want to call it a paragraph. Anyway, in that essay, he talks about how precious your paradigms are. There's nothing more precious than a paradigm, how you see things and how you understand things. So therefore, those people who are just outright conscientious objectors to supporting the Constitution, then they should lose their citizenship. They shouldn't be able to vote, and they should be labeled as an inhabitant, a taxed inhabitant. Now, when we look at reconstituting, and I think where I left off was, I was talking about the federal funding, reconstituting our security system, and the federal funding to mercenary forces, as well as sheriffs and those types of things, you know, where we have actually seen in multiple cities across America where they're getting MRAPs and all sorts of armored personnel carriers and the military grade gear for a mercenary force. Folks, so what's a mercenary force? A mercenary force is a professional force that basically executes the law, or like your police department. Your municipal police department is a mercenary force. Now, when you look at the militia, that is not a mercenary force. That is a required organization, constitutionally required organization that all people have to share that responsibility. And I'm, you know, there's a lot of really smart people on this. And I'm the dumbest guy in the room when it comes to the militia. I understand the constitutionality. I understand, you know, the structure. Like, I understand that the Army and the Air Force should not exist. We are not, we have no threat to the homeland. The only purpose for them, or I should say the Army, the fact that they even broke up the Army into the Air Force is just repugnant. But it would be homeland forces. As a matter of fact, as far as I'm concerned, a long time ago, when I was still wearing a uniform, I felt that it actually should have been U.S. Armed Forces, not, you know, USAF. But then I realized that you have the homeland and you have the external protection, your external security system. Your external security system is the Navy and the Marine Corps, period. Now, the Marine Corps is a department of the Navy, and as we like to say, it's the men's department. And I know I just probably insulted a lot of sailors out there. But, and there's, folks, if you don't know, there's always this banter and ribbing between services. And so with that, I don't want to make a long play on and a long discussion going down a deep rat hole on the banter. That being said, when we really look at who should be dealing with Space Force, that should be the Navy. When we look at the Coast Guard, that should be the Navy. Anything that is guarding our external borders. Now, when I say our external, what I mean external is where we actually hit international, not our border between Mexico and Canada. Militias should be manning and managing those. Because at this point in time, we do not have a hostile force that's threatening us. And the bottom line is, when it comes to the defenses of the mainland, when it comes to the defenses of the United States proper, Canada, Hawaii, what have you, the defending of every piece of sand, every grain of sand on the beach, and every inch of land on in Hawaii, Alaska, or any other U.S. territory that should be transitioned by now as a state, that should be handled by the militia and the external outside of that. In other words, when it comes to the islands, technically the islands, the Hawaii Islands, Guam, those types of places, it's really hard to have just an army defending that. I mean, you need to have the hardened, or I should say forts, and those types of installations to actually, you know, have the forces, you know, garrisoned so that they can deploy at any part of the island if they're being invaded. But you got to remember that the real key thing that the militia is going to do every day is execute the laws. If we want to have lots of laws, then they need to be executed. And if they need to be executed because we're not willing to go along with the legitimate laws of the federal government, and more importantly, the laws of the state as well as the county. Because bottom line, the militia should be executing the laws throughout our governments. Because the federal government can't meddle with hardly anything domestic-wise. They shouldn't, only taxation. So that's it. I mean, they don't have any rights to forest or any land, any form of land. So when we really look and start peeling back what the federal government has created in enforcement agencies such as the ATF and so forth, they're not constitutional. The FBI, not constitutional. There's a lot of people that talk about getting rid of them, but technically those people should be transitioned into the militia. Technically, and I know that there's some real hard ideological people in some of these federal positions. If they're not going to be willing to support the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, the Constitution of the state where they're employed, then they should not have that job. Period. If they're an ideologue, if they want to, you know, basically promote and enforce agendas and all sorts of unconstitutional things, bottom line, that's what we're seeing. And as a matter of fact, many of them have never questioned whether they have the constitutional authority to do what they're doing. In the military, one of the things you learn is you are required to carry out lawful orders. A lawful order is only an order that is actually within the framework or within the powers of the law that that commander can give you. They cannot order you to do something that is unlawful. In other words, if it's a violation of the Constitution, then they can't order you to do that. And that kind of goes to the intel side when we actually see that they're doing things that they shouldn't be doing. So anyway, so we kind of covered the funding needs to be shifted, because when we really look at the responsibility of, and this is going up to, you know, a previous comment as well, when we look at what we brought up already, who is supposed to be doing paying for the training of the militia? It's the federal government. Who's supposed to be executing the training? Who's supposed to be in charge of the training? Now, the federal government should have the standards of making sure that these are the weapons you need and boom, 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 all this, these standards, and they pay for those standards to be developed, established, possibly even a curriculum for suggestion. But the states are the ones that are responsible for actually performing the training. Now, I will say this, that being 200 years out from the Constitution and being in a point in time of technology, I honestly believe that we need to use technologies to keep costs down, because I don't think we need to be spending as much federal dollars in the training side. Why? Now, I say this a lot to a lot of people, but in person, but I never say this on the air. I don't think I've ever reference this website on the air, but I use this website as an example, because when we really look at how many people we need in teaching today, we don't need that many. And what I mean by that is there can be very good quality, effective training. Now, there's certain things that, you know, like a coach or what have you, in, you know, doing the physical execution of whatever you have to do. But when it comes to understanding the theory of mathematics, there's no reason why you can't learn from the same, whoever the best teacher in the nation is. In other words, when we really look at education, and I want to give you one example, is math. There's a man that actually went on a crusade in trying to help kids learn math. And I don't know his name because I'm terrible with this, but I do remember his website. His website is yaymath.org, Y-A-Y-M-A-T-H, yaymath.org. I would invite you to go there just to, with this in mind, just to go there and examine what he does. He can teach any child the basics of math and get you into college level math. Now, would you rather have this guy as your teacher, or would you rather have that pogue, you know, because there's lots of pogues in the school system today that really are there because they're ideologues. They're liberals that want to get you to think and function in a very specific way. And they know they don't have a camera on them 24/7 like this guy does when he teaches his class. Why? Because these are awesome classes. I mean, if you look at the videos, and if you're a parent, you will definitely want to have your children watch these, because this guy's engaging. He dresses up. He dresses up as a Roman or a person, you know, a character in Star Trek. Different types of characters this guy puts on, these personas. And when you watch his videos, it gets very engaging. And some, a lot of times the it's just a costume. It may not have some direct relevance to what he's teaching, but sometimes it does. But more importantly, he gets the kids excited about learning about math and about being able to conquer every little, you know, rise, you know, this foothill, this mountain, you know, taking on factoring and different forms of formulas of geography and so forth. Folks, why do we have to spend and employ 100 or thousands of people in the classroom when that those classes right there do it? And as a matter of fact, he's nonprofit. And as a matter of fact, these are so good that a long, long time, this guy's been around for a long time. And I, you know, he'd probably be very, very unhappy with somebody like me with a constitutional paradigm trying to teach you about the Constitution, because I don't know if he's constitutional or not. Most teachers aren't. But my point is this. Here's a guy that can teach your kids, and actually what he did for me, because instead of going through, because this is another thing kids don't know, are people that have been in the military, and they've basically had a lot of training, and they can't get that training matriculated because the money bag school systems today want to make sure they squeeze every dollar, so they do everything they can to not matriculate your basic stuff. And so one of the things I did was I actually went to yaymath.org because, you know, when I was in college working on my business degree after I got out, I actually went out and, you know, some kids said, hey, because I started to take this class. And these kids go, well, why are you here? Because, you know, obviously I'm older than them. And they said, you know, I told them I needed to get these classes. And they go, you know about CLEP? And I go, yeah, I know about CLEP. You know, there's Dante's CLEP, and I guess there's some other certifications of how you can challenge classes. And they said, well, why don't you CLEP? And I go, well, I'd have to review a lot of stuff. And they go, well, go to yaymath.org and drop the class. Took yaymath. Actually, I just watched it. I took one day and went through all of the little different formulas and refreshed my memory. And I go, wow, that was awesome. How would that help me go and challenge my math class? And I clept out. And actually, there was other courses that I took that were similar to Yay Math or other refreshers that were so helpful that I was able to take care of 28 credit hours in just a couple weeks. Well, actually, it took about 3-4 weeks. So anyway, the point is this, folks, that when it comes to the training, the military, or I should say the militia, there's no reason why the states can't actually share the training or actually seek for the best and the brightest trainers, those who are the most effective, those who can make learning defense systems and defense tactics and even offensive tactics fun. Now, I had a lot of fun when I went through the Marine Corps training, but... And I know that, I'll just say this. I know that there's a lot of people that went through the Marine Corps, and it was, you know, something that they never liked. There were points in time when I hated it, and there were points in time when I loved it. But bottom line, when you learn these things, if you really pay attention, because they always say, the more you sweat in, you know, in training, the less you bleed in battle. And you got to take this stuff seriously because, folks, we are the defense. And the way the federal government has been managing this social engineering with our military, they've got millions of people in the military today, and they're actually indoctrinating them and enabling them and getting their loyalty because, oh, well, they're paying for their gender reassignments or what have you. They're doing things that they actually should not be doing. And as a matter of fact, when you go through the military standards, the UCMJ and the laws, I don't know if Congress has ever lifted the laws, but the fact that they're allowing things should not happen because they're in direct conflict with things like adultery or fornication or those types of things or fraternization. Anyway, so the next thing that we need to talk about is the strategic value that is in every state. And we kind of glossed over this, but we need to dive into this because this is the new part we want to cover into. And obviously it's taken me half the show. So what I'll try to do is I'll try to cover this and then we'll dive into the common law stuff that I still needed to get into. We'll be right back after this promo. So stay tuned, folks. We'll be right back. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so we kind of talked a little bit about the positioning of military bases or security forces throughout the United States. We talked about having them on the coastline. We've talked about having them throughout the borders from Mexico and along the northern border for Canada and where the real threats are. But more importantly, when we look at the strategic placement, this is where the states really need to actually look at what they've got. Now, first off, has the property been paid for? Has it been properly paid for by the federal government? Now, here's the thing. If the federal government pays for it, this is why I think most of this land should have been leased, so that it, at a certain point, it has to be reviewed whether you renew the lease. Many military bases that are leased that I know of are really, they're pennies on the acre of what they're paying for. So in other words, it's a stipend that they're giving to the state. So all of this needs to be reviewed as far as whether the military is actually paying a going rate. Because, you know, when the military actually reimburses you, they're not going to give you, you know, a really accurate. They give you what they believe and they calculate as the going rate, like the wear and tear on your car and so forth. Now, in some ways, they've gone to ad nauseum. They've gone to a great deal of effort in trying to make sure that you get a certain amount, but that's based on the average car. And so the average car, the value of the average car, because if you really look, it's kind of funny how this works out. The majority of the cars in the pool that they use, you know, throughout all of the cars sold, the majority of those cars are cheap. They're not expensive. They're not exotic, or they're not necessarily expensive maintenance. Let's say you choose to buy a diesel. Let's say you choose to buy a nice vehicle. Then your maintenance is going to be far more. Now, can you claim, you know, that your wear and tear and maintenance on your vehicle is going to, you need more for that? No. They come up with a formula because it serves them to actually have the lowest price. It's fair for the person that has the average car or a cheap car. So that's what happens when you play with the government. But bottom line, the government should be paying the state a fair sum instead of renewing these things on the cheap. But all that still needs to be evaluated. It needs to be determined whether those bases, because let's look at it this way. The militia, the U.S. Army, for military training, does it really need to have its own? Or should it be able to use the Marine Corps for their ground, unless there's something really unique that the Army has a requirement to be able to do to guard the homeland? And some of those things might be, I don't know. I mean, I'm having a hard time thinking of what the Army would be doing that would be different. But let's talk about special forces. We already have how many different special forces? You got an agency out there. You got a department out there like the Air Force. You got the Army. You have the Navy. And you have the Marine Corps. And they all have their own special forces. So here's the question. Do we really need all of those? Does the Army really need a special forces to defend the homeland? I don't think so. As a matter of fact, maintaining and managing a special forces is really for strategic purposes. So I think that a lot of those types of things that the Army has would go away. Delta Force and that. And I know this is sacrilege. But when we look at what the government is supposed to have, it's not whether you like doing it. It's not whether it, you know, you think it's a good idea. Bottom line, the federal government should not be maintaining an army. It should be a militia. And when they need it, they federalize it by calling it up from the states. And they decide what states they need or if they need all states because we're in an invasion. Or because we're executing law, a new tax. But bottom line, the need for the U.S. Army, if you really look over the last century, it would be based on the laws or the constitutional objects and the lack of their ability to directly derive any new laws from the what is delegated, then the Army really wouldn't ever be out there executing the laws. The places where they'd be executing laws is at the state and or the county. And this is where the governor should be using the militia as designed through each of the counties, because the sheriff should have a requisite force to be able to execute the laws of the county and the governor for the state. So when we really start looking at, you know, this structure of where we need the militia to be, do we need it to be to serve the county and state more? Absolutely. Now, that what that means is we have to shift the burden over to those states. Now, I'm going to tell you right now, California would probably be the most expensive just because it has the most amount of people and because it has the highest crime rates, or it's up there. Same thing with New York. And same thing where we've allowed invaders to occupy the land. So that's another thing that the militia has to do, is they have to repel the invaders. They have to suppress insurrections and repel invaders. So when we look at the retention of military bases, there really needs to be a head scratcher and a deep conversation at the state level first and then among the states. You know, because if some states say, we just want to get rid of ours completely. Well, you can, but there are some strategic interests that the Navy would probably need, such as air bases, such as silos for boomers and those types of things, electronic operations for surveillance of, you know, incoming aircraft, submarine communications, all of that. So there needs to be a discussion of what goes and what doesn't go. But I'll tell you, folks, the releasing of that land. Now, if the U.S. government paid for it, then it needs to be paid. In other words, they need to basically relinquish that, and the state needs to basically pay them back for getting that land back. Because bottom line, they own that land for as long as they need it. If they don't need it, it goes back to the state. So again, this means that what we want to do is start leasing and converting all the land into leases, because then they really don't own it. And then they can pay pennies on the dollar, or at least a fair share for the land. What we need to also do is we need to start looking at worldwide bases and ask, why do we have an army base there and why do we have a Air Force base there? Because if we really need to have ground forces in another nation, then it needs to be the Marine Corps. Even though the Marine Corps likes to be light and so forth, and it should be. But the real question is, why do we have ground forces? deployed at this point in time, this far away from the rebuilding and reconstruction of the world that we paid for, we subsidized. So when it comes to strategic, like air bases and those types of things, then I can see the role there. But an occupying force, I do not see that. I do not see that. And so we need to look at how much we really need to have throughout, what, Italy, throughout Japan, throughout all of the nations that we have deployed or created bases. Germany. I know that these are great duties for the military guys. Great. But we don't have a military so that people can have great tours. We have a military to basically perform a very specific function. So as we start looking at what we need to do in transitioning all of this, then I'm going to tell you that the people of these different nations are going to be very happy getting their land back. They may not be happy with the fact that they're not getting any money. And oh, by the way, when it comes down to the purpose of the Navy, not only defending us, it defends our interests. In other words, just remember, Thomas Jefferson sent out the Navy and the Marine Corps to Tripoli to basically get back our commerce in the ship that was stolen by the Ottoman Empire. Why do we do that? Because we have to protect our interests. So the bottom line is, for years and years and years, we have been the police, the world cop. We've been able to, you know, maintain the secure travel or the flowing of commerce for the world. And the world has benefited off of our money or our expenditures of securing and making the sea waters in most areas. I mean, pirating just came back to be just, what, in the past few decades. it has gone down significantly and it started on the rise again. But the point is this, is that those other nations need to actually start providing a navy themselves. If they have commerce flowing, then they need to help fund the navy's costs. In other words, they need to help fund that. Or they need to have their own navy. And ergo, if they're not funding it, the reason they need to have it is because we need to tell the world any flags, any ship that's flying our flags, any ship that is, you know, basically pulling through the pulling through the channels and the straits and what have you, that is out, you know, gathering or moving their commerce. The whole point is that they have to have responsibility for it. It is not our responsibility. I may poke Ron Paul in the eye, and the Pauls or anybody that has the pacifist type of, you know, appeal to the kids today, the libertarians and so forth. But when it comes down to who should pay, we shouldn't. So therefore, any ship that is actually flying our flag should be basically, we would need to come up with some way of recognizing that though they should be punished, because what they would do is they would just fly our flag so that they wouldn't be harassed. I talked about that before. I know I did. And so we actually have to have a process and or a procedure of holding them accountable. All right. So at this point, as we've talked about the transitioning of bases within the U.S. and bases within the world, folks, that's going to free up the defense budget significantly. But what that's going to do is it's going to allow the military, or I should say the defense budget, to be shifted into helping educate and training the U.S. citizen. I believe that this education and training, because it is a requirement and it's a federal law, and I believe that any state that doesn't want to teach these things is going to be held liable, and any governor or any politician at the state level that wants to say, no, we're not going to participate in this, then they will be removed. This is a constitutional duty. when they raise their arm to support the Constitution, there must be a well-provided and well-equipped militia. Remember? Remember the security of, you know, the what is it? What is that Second Amendment, right? And so let me just pull it up and go to the Second Amendment. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. So any governor, any legislature, any judge that actually rules to say, we're not allowing you to actually educate our citizens, then they are violating the Constitution, because it is essential that we have well-regulated militias for the states and for this nation. We have to. This is how we start changing paradigms. Can Trump actually do this? Absolutely, he could. Will he? That is the bigger question. Will Trump actually want to do the right thing? So, with that, I want to just basically kind of break free from this, and we'll get into part three of this on Friday, and whatever we have left on basically going back to the strategic reconstituting of our national security system, right? Okay, so let me dive into common law, because this is one of the things that really baffles people. And I've had several conversations with lawyers and students of common law, and I have found that most people do not really, most people that think they know common law, they really don't. Because what they understand in common law is that it was transitioned without transforming. In other words, it came from and was maintained in the same form as Britain as it is here in America. This is why I have met evangelical common law preachers. And what I mean by that is many of the common law preachers have basically placed the biblical context, in other words, the monarchical theocracy context of common law, and said that that's a part of America today. That is our common law system, that the Bible be the supreme law of the land, and it's not. And I know this may infuriate some people or may frustrate people. That may seem to be contrary to what everybody's teaching you. Let me ask you this. Is America a theocracy? Was America established to be a theocracy? Is the supreme law of the land the Bible, or is it the Constitution? Well, if it's the Constitution, then when you look at the legal system that you create, the legal system is designed to support that law, whatever that law is. And if that law is limited and defined, then that court at the federal level is based upon that law. So, when we look at how they go well beyond those enumerated objects, because again, if it doesn't arise under the Constitution, the federal government shouldn't even be involved in it. That goes for your state too. So when you look at the state, many of the states actually did have theocracies. And it was appropriate at the state level for allowing the Bible to be the supreme law of the land. When they went away from having a symbiotic relationship between church and having the churches be independent from the state, and the state started taking over compassion services, providing health care, or, you know, I'll just say health assistance to the youth and so forth in the 1800s, how they started actually doing those types of things, then the common law needed to be reframed. It needed to be transitioned to that state constitution. Now, because you never had county constitutions, it was just this quagmire, because bottom line, most people were thinking that, oh, well, because the county didn't have constitutions, then, you know, the common law was the Bible, or the, you know, based on the Bible, and it couldn't be. So what would happen? Because where does common law should actually be available to the people at the county level? In our architecture, we should have two court systems for your availability. Those things that are delegated to your government, that is the court that they have. And then when you have other things that do not fall into those enumerated powers, a separate court system needs to exist. And that court system would be a common law court system. And that is where it is based upon whatever so nine times out of ten, this goes to the statutes that the people start making for themselves. It is not based upon the statutes of another county. That county may have a different constitution, but you have to have a constitution first to actually be able to truly establish your common law court. Because now you've created a court that is based upon your constitution to serve your county government. It doesn't mean that your county government can't provide you a common law court, but the only court that they have, the only jurisdiction over the matters for the county in the county court are those things delegated. So folks, if you're understanding the beauty of a constitutional republic, a constitutional republic's left everything to the people. Actually, when you really looked at how the governing of behavior was done in the first 70 years, it was done by the shunning from the churches. Whatever church you went to, if everybody knew you did something you shouldn't have done, you were shunned. And back in those days, it was hard to pack up and move somewhere so you could, run away from that. And there were people that did that, but a lot of times that would catch up with them. Because somebody would come by that would know of you. Well, we got this guy. He's from your area. Oh, that's where the charlatan. They change their names. And it gets discovered. And then all of a sudden they have to move again. So when we look at common law, we actually have to determine how to do that and how to implement that and how to do that at the county. This is why when we look at Blackstone's commentaries on common law, how it easily was a broad-brushed plan for the United Kingdom or for Britain, because everything was all underneath the monarchy. The monarchy had these powers, and the restrictions of those powers were based on those things that were, these inalienable rights. These reserved rights for the people. And those came out of the Bible. And if something was challenged, and all of a sudden something new came along, goes, well, we've never been hit with this before. Is it something that's still reserved in the Bible? Then that would be the process of you using common law to say, hey, this is a right. This is a God-given right. Like having babies. Nobody made having babies a God-given right in the Magna Carta. Interestingly enough, it now has to be applied because nobody would have thought that you actually had to mention that. And so when we really look at how antithetical government has become when it comes to the family, when it actually is attacking the family structure, and those very precious things, they never included that. It's like parental rights. Does a person have a right? I mean, again, this goes back to how Mr. Iredell in the North Carolina debates was basically using this argument about trying to make up a comprehensive a comprehensive enumeration of rights. This is what he said. This is out of the North Carolina debates. He says, did any man ever hear before that at the end of a power of attorney, it was said that the attorney shall not exercise more power than was there given him? And he's asking a question. And the reason he's placing this in this way, because it's just common knowledge that the only thing a person can do with a limited power of attorney is exercise power that is not there granted. They can't go and do these things. So he goes on and says, suppose for an instance a man had lands in the counties of Anson and Coswell, and he should give another person a power of attorney to sell his lands in Anson. Okay, I got these lands over there, go sell them. Would the other have any authority to sell the lands? So would this agent that he's given this power of attorney to, would he have the power to sell the lands in Coswell as well? Or could he, without absurdity, say, 'Tis true you have not expressly authorized me to sell the lands in Coswell, but as you had lands there and did not say I should not, I thought I might as well sell those lands as the other.'" And this is where he sums this up, a very nice, short, and succinct. "A bill of rights, as I conceive, would not only be incongruous, but dangerous. No man, let his ingenuity be what it will, could enumerate all of the individual rights not relinquished by this constitution, or by that constitution of your county." So in other words, those things that are actually not enumerated, they can't have those courts hear these things. This is why we have to have, if we don't reinstate a religious, and the problem with having a multi-religious state or county, in other words, allowing the churches and the pastors to basically police themselves, the problem is it won't be uniform, because there will be some that will be far more tolerant, some that will be far more strict. And so it needs to be somewhat uniform. And I believe this is where we need to have common law courts that are there based upon these, this is where the framers actually instituted this principle of the laws of nature, nature's God. We should actually be using that, even though it is not based on the Bible, but it is based on the Bible, I should say. It is not a Bible itself. It's not this version or that version. This is something that actually needs to be reviewed. So here's the problem. When you look at the laws of nature, nature's God, there needs to be a clear, common day translation of what all that means. And then it is for each county to basically hammer out what that is, so that that's how the common law court will basically help assist protecting the rights of the people. Remember, folks, the two objects of government, the reason why we institute government, is for these two purposes: to protect life and to protect private property. That's it. And so when government is not protecting life and or your rights, these fundamental rights, which is your private property as well, then government is doing things that it has no business. We didn't institute it for those purposes. You may want to change it to do those things, but the only way to do that is through an amendment. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.